the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy, and it's great to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. You can get a hold of Golf News Net, your favorite social media service at Golf News Net. Head to our website, golfnewsnet.com. Download our apps for Roku and Amazon TV. And we are presented by BetDSI.com. We love using their easy-to-use mobile interface. You can bet on everything in golf from weekly winners, matchups, in-game, and you can extend that entertainment all the way through your sports, your politics, your WWE, you name it. You can put a little wager on it and make a little money on the side. If you use the promo code GOLFNEWS25 at BetDSI.com, you're going to get a free $25 wager on the house and a 200% match on your first deposit. Again, BetDSI.com, promo code GOLFNEWS25. One quick other kind of housekeeping item for GNN. We have launched the $4 Show, which is our weekly look at fantasy golf, golf betting, golf analytics. And we finally come up with a plan after 3 weeks of trying to figure out how the hell we're going to do this. But each week we're going to do, on Mondays, a fantasy golf podcast, just audio. We'll dig into a bunch of different things. Obviously, we're hitting the off-season of golf. So we'll talk a little bit about data. We'll talk a little bit about numbers in the abstract for the weeks where there's not a PGA Tour event, which is obviously rare. But we'll have that for basically November and December. And then when we come back in January, we'll talk about that PGA Tour event that week and also all of the things that kind of go into that: player modeling, course modeling, top bets, top players, sleepers. We'll go through all of that. And then on Tuesday, the next day, we will have a live stream video that'll be on Periscope, our website, and Facebook Live, so that we can connect that way with just a couple of topics that may have come up, kind of news related to the tournament, some things we're thinking about based on the headlines that we have, the data that we have available, and we'll dig into that in a video format. Then we'll take that, make that an audio file, and put that up with the podcast as well. So in preparation for all of that, if you're a fantasy golf player, head over to iTunes, and you can download the first $4 Show so you can kind of get a better sense of my mission for the program, but also my thoughts and MO about fantasy golf and golf betting in general. And then you'll be pretty well prepared for the stuff that's coming your way in November and December. And BetDSI.com has graciously agreed to step up and sponsor that show as well. So we're grateful to have their support. I want to get into a couple of things because we haven't done a podcast in November. So our last podcast was with Kyle Thompson, who was great. Really happy to have had him on the show, and so many of you were able to listen to the program, the interview, and enjoy it. But I wanted to kick off our show today with some really interesting news, I think, and it's probably flying a little bit under the radar given the time of year, and that there aren't a whole lot of people taking in golf.com's video programming relative to their website, probably because the pivot to video is hard, but they're doing really good stuff on video, and they got a fascinating scoop, in my view, from their golf live program with Ryan Aselta, who was interviewing the Bridgestone CEO, Angel Yagan, and I'm probably going to butcher that, but if you want to say it in Spanglish, Angel Yagan, but it's Angel Yagan probably. And he says that it's time for a standardized tour ball. Here's his quote: as it relates to the tour, ellipsis, there needs to be something to standardize the ball because the guys are hitting it way too far. He adds later, quote, I think there is an option to have a ball that is played on tour and a ball that is played casually, end quote. And he adds later that he gives it maybe a 50-50 chance of a standardized distance ball appearing on the PGA Tour in the near future, not 20 years from now, the near future. Jeff Shackelford, I think, rightly points out in writing about this that perhaps the reason this has come up and this was talked about is perhaps because Bridgestone has made such a ball, perhaps because the USGA is looking into this. Remember, Tiger Woods has talked about a call for rolling the golf ball back. That has been a popular topic in golf the last month or so, the last few weeks, where he's talked about it. And obviously, he plays a Bridgestone ball under contract. So, to me, that seems like they kind of know what's going on. And remember, Woods said that in talking about that ball rollback with Gino Auriemma on his podcast, that he had data or evidence to suggest that the USGA was already looking at rollbacks of golf ball distance as much as 20%. So you take what the Bridgestone CEO has, and you take what Tiger Woods has, you take that they're under the same umbrella, and it seems to make sense that maybe these guys know something that we don't know, and that would be very reasonable to assume. I don't think, then, if the USGA went this way, we would see a single golf ball. Like, it wouldn't be like the PGA Tour brand golf ball everybody gets to use on the PGA Tour, and you use a different ball on the European Tour, LPGA Tour, etc. I don't think that that's what they mean. I think that you would have multiple manufacturers making ball to a tighter spec than is currently allowed by the USGA and the RNA. And I've written about this process or this discussion extensively. We've talked about on the show over the years how I think it's a good idea to believe in bifurcation, how you could have a tolerance or set of rules for equipment for high-level amateurs and professionals, and you could have a set of equipment rules and standards for amateurs, just the everyday person that's not going to play competitive golf. And that would be akin to what we've seen with the introduction of the Grooves rules, which actually don't take effect until 2020 for normal golfers. So if you're playing with compliant grooves now, you're ahead of schedule. And they had different phase-ins for pros, which was pretty much right away, high-level amateurs, and then normal people, everyday recreational golfers. And I've been formulating in my head this idea for a written piece, how hypothetically such a rollout would go. It's something I want to try to pursue in the off season, because I think we probably couldn't get a lot of people on the record about it, just because it would be an indication that they've thought about it a little too hard. But I think you could get people from all ends. You could get people from the regulatory side, so to speak, the USGA and the RNA, to explain what that might look like. And then you could get some thoughts from the folks in the OEM and manufacturing space to say, this is what maybe we have done so far in terms of providing equipment to the USGA and the RNA for such testing, what they might imagine it would look like for their business to have a golf ball that the pros play and a golf ball that everyone else plays. That would be interesting. I think, though, the end conclusion is going to be the same, because I'm biased, but the end conclusion would be the same, that there's going to come a day where you're going to need to do this. We've gotten way too many public indications in the last 12 months, including from the USGA's Mike Davis, as it relates to the rewrite of the rules, that he could see the possibility of a variable distance golf ball to make certain courses, his example was Myopia Hunt, shorter courses still reasonable for long hitters to go play as they were intended, as opposed to just guys just blasting away with the modern ball and making them useless and rendering them incompetent, you know, meaningless, impotent. So I think that that is a possibility, and I think that the more talk we hear about this publicly, they're trying to lay a groundwork for the possibility that this could happen. That it's now come on the OEM side, I think, is a fascinating development. I don't think you're going to hear outgoing titleless CEO Wally Uhlein come out and say, yeah, we should totally come up with a ball that takes away our competitive advantage because people play Pro V1s because they're everywhere. I mean, they're every player on the PGA Tour, you know, overwhelming number of them, I should say. You look at the ball count every week, 90 to 100 players play a Pro V1, and that's out of 132 to 156 players. I mean, that's a huge market share. And the ubiquity of those balls on the PGA Tour has led to ubiquity among a lot of golfers. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the same advantage that it once was. You've got great manufacturers like Bridgestone, Callaway, TaylorMade, Srixon, even smaller operations like Snell and Cut that have come out with, and Encore, which has improved their product dramatically, that have, Wilson has caught something with the softer golf ball that is starting to kind of proliferate more. So there are more options now than ever, and that has diminished some of Titleist's advantage, among some other competitive issues. But still, if Titleist were to come out tomorrow and say, yeah, you know what, we should have a pro ball, we should have a ball for touring players, that would be a jaw-dropping development. It would be completely unexpected, because the day that you come out with a tour ball is the day you lose the ability to tout how many players on the PGA, European, and LPGA tours, web.com, and go down the line, how many of those players are playing your ball. Because if they're all kind of standardized within certain tolerances, right, with certain spin profiles, with certain spin gaps, that's something we've heard a lot about, is what is the difference in spin rate off of a driver versus with a wedge, and that the USGA wants to tighten that range too. That could be where they go next with regulation of the golf ball, if they don't go all out toward a tour ball, for example. So for Titleist, they're the one that hurts the most if we go to this from that marketing perspective, because their tagline is the number one ball in golf. And I realize that that's true for amateurs, but it's kind of predicated on the fact that touring pros are their numbers use Titleist. Their ranks use them tremendously high percentage of the time. So if you were to go to, say, a Titleist, all right, you're going to have to make a tour ball, and that means normal amateurs are probably not going to play it, even if they have access to it, because it won't go as far. So then all of a sudden you won't be able to say you can play the same ball as the pros plays. It's for you too. Buy our ball. You can't. It would be a different marketing animal entirely. But for companies like Bridgestone, which have really gone toward ball fitting, ball personalization, trying to create profiles around the amateur golfer instead of saying, here are our touring pros we pay to play our ball, please play our ball. They've said, all right, well, we've got ball solutions for you, whether you are a lower swing speed player and want a softball, get in like the E6 world. If you want a tour performance ball but don't swing fast enough, we've got Tour BRX. If you want, or RXS, if you are a faster swing speed player and you're just not good enough to play on the PGA Tour, but you hit the ball long enough with enough swing speed, then here's our Tour BX and Tour BXS. Play those. You've got all those different ball models for capturing most golfers. You've got that from Wilson, who's obviously not a big player in terms of paying players to play their golf ball. And even if they did, they don't really tout their tour-level golf ball. They tout their 29 compression golf ball that's really soft, the Duo Soft. If you're Callaway, they've made strides with Chrome Soft, obviously, that make it a well-liked golf ball, and it feels a little bit softer, but it has that kind of performance aspect of it. But they're not talking as much about that ball on tour. I mean, it wins, but they're not talking about that as much. They're talking about what that means for the average player. And the other smaller companies look at it the same way. Yeah, they tout when their tour players win, but they're looking more toward the amateur to make the decision for themselves, for a ball custom for them and their game, instead of playing the ball for the tour player, which most, I think, people in the know would tell you is a bad idea for most golfers. They're just not going to get the same kind of performance benefits out of them, and they're paying too much money. So when we get to that point where this could happen, if this 50-50 coin flip from Yagan is true, then all of a sudden that changes the game. I mean, that changes golf equipment marketing, golf equipment manufacturing. And really, I would think, based on this support from Bridgestone, which obviously a big player in the space, I would think that you're more likely to not get a lawsuit from a group of manufacturers so much as the USGA would get sued by one big manufacturer with, yes, deep pockets, but not something that they could pursue forever, especially considering that the USGA has a lot of money in their pocket now from Fox, from their television deal, which is, you know, $100 million a year, from the revenue they make from their U.S. Open and the other championships, but the U.S. Open's obviously the most profitable one. And so they could fight a lawsuit. They could say, well, we're doing this. And if they do that, then if they say, well, we want to roll the ball back, then you got to sue the PGA Tour too. Because if the PGA Tour agrees to it, and they might, I mean, I don't know where that stands, but if Jay Monahan comes out and says, you know, we should have a ball like this. I want to go to different places. I want to go play different clubs that are unique and architecturally interesting, and we can't play them right now because this golf ball goes too far. If he takes on that, then Titleist or someone else has to sue them too, and they've got to sue the RNA, and that's extremely costly very quickly in a world where margins are not what they were, and in a world where the manufacturer doesn't have the same marketing power to tell stories around what tour players are doing, and now they have to focus more on what the individual golfer is doing and what the ball can do for that individual player instead of just the golfer kind of blindly going into a pro shop or a green grass and saying, I just want to play what Ricky Fowler plays. I just want to play what Justin Thomas plays. No one does that anymore. I've not seen that in years, and it's finally becoming hip to it. The most of the OEMs, and those are the ones that kind of lag in terms of ball share, but they have come around to appealing to the amateur player. They haven't the recreational player. They have appealed to that instead of trying to say, well, these are our guys and they play our ball, so you should too. Okay. We've moved on from that. So I'm interested to see what this going public with it means. Are all of us, is Chip Brewer next week going to say, yeah, I'm in. Yeah, we could do the standardized ball. That's cool. No big deal. I mean, Callaway makes 11 different iron sets. So what, obviously there are several on the muscle back blade end that are not meant for any of us except high level players. And then there are some on the opposite end, which are not meant for anybody but the worst. So what's the difference between having that kind of breadth and personalization available in 11 different iron sets and having that different breadth and personalization available in golf balls and just adding one, maybe two models that have a limited flight capacity and are specifically designed for tournament golf? What's the difference? Not much. So interested to see what happens with that next. We're going to go and take a break. We'll come back after these messages. All right, welcome back to the show. Here's the second half of the program. The one thing I've found really interesting in recent weeks is, especially this time of year right now, the PGA of America, and the USGA for that matter, because they announced the U.S. Open's return to Pebble Beach, and then they announced the U.S. Women's Open there same day, which for the first time, which is awesome. But we've also seen this from the PGA of America in the last several weeks, announcements of new or upcoming venues, I should say, for their major championships. So in recent weeks, we have learned Olympic Club will host the 2028 PGA Championship and 2032 Ryder Cup. We've learned Arana Mink will host the 2020 Women's PGA Championship and the 2027 PGA Championship. We've learned Valhalla, which the PGA of America owns, will get another crack 10 years after the 2014 PGA Championship, which ended so dramatically with Rory McIlroy winning, and that'll be in 2024, and they're going to host something else too, I think a junior PGA Championship. So in this span of time, we've heard some big announcements in terms of major championship venues, and from reading between the lines a little bit, I get the sense that there's a bit of an arms race here between the USGA and the PGA of America. And I say that for one primary reason. Because when Olympic Club all of a sudden flipped from being a USGA facility hosting, you know, a handful, half dozen US Opens, US Amateurs, other events, and they became a PGA of America facility, Ron Krojcik with the San Francisco Chronicle, who was always on things in that golf scene, reported that as recently as earlier in the year, in the summertime, early fall even, that the USGA was negotiating with Olympic to bring another U.S. Open there. So last hosted in 2012, that's when Webb Simpson won and Jungle Bird got tackled by Mike Davis, and oh, it was great. And the tournament wasn't as great, but anyway. And so we had that finale in 2012, and they wanted to get another crack at it and bring it back to Olympic, and it's a good venue. It's wide, obviously, 36-hole facility, massive space, great for the U.S. Open. It's in San Francisco, so that means it's in prime time. The weather's generally pretty good. It's not going to be hot. It's not going to be cold either. It's like 70 degrees, 65, 70 degrees. That's awesome. It would be perfect. But Krawczyk reported that the club and the USGA couldn't come together on a fee. They couldn't come together on how much the Olympic Club would make as a result of hosting the championship. And I think that that is a very interesting development because it sounded like they might have been slotted in a time when the USGA's contract with Fox would end. So they need venues to think well into the future, the USGA does, for their next television contract. They're thinking, there's no way, I mean, I'm thinking, just based on where the world's going to be in the middle of the next decade, there's no way they're going to be able to get $1 billion for that length of deal, even with inflation, from anyone to air the U.S. Open. It's just, it can't be there. There's no way. I mean, we won't know how many people have access to cable and are kind of blindly paying for channels they never watch, but that number is certainly going to be less than what it is in 2017. We've already lost something where people have lost like 11 million cable subscriptions because ESPN has dropped like 11 million homes, and that's everybody gets ESPN. So if that number is starting to accelerate, maybe we're 30 million or 40 million people by the middle of the next decade, which means all of a sudden cable is still very, very powerful, but not in 100 million homes. It's in 60 or 70 million. And that's a big difference. That's a big money difference every month. When you consider that you pay $7 or so per month to your cable provider for ESPN, that means you're paying them with everything you get, if you get the deuce and the other stuff, paying them about $100, a little bit more than that per year. So if you take away, they already took away 10 million people. If you take away another 30 million people, that's a lot of money. Every year, that's a lot of money that you're taking away. And all of a sudden, that trickles down to other channels. Golf Channel is hard hit by this because Comcast owns them, so they give everybody Golf Channel as a sports channel because they own the thing. They want to charge you the whatever dollar it is per month. So as people shed Comcast and go to find other alternatives, then Golf Channel's hit pretty hard. Fox Sports is going to be the same thing, same situation. It is cheaper, dramatically cheaper than ESPN. I think it's like $1.70 or something like that. But still, that's a lot of money every month to them. And Fox, there's no way Fox is going to be able to pay for that. And there's a very realistic possibility that Fox's entertainment wing could be broken up, spliced up. They can only do news and sports. What's that going to look like? So there are a lot of things out there that are uncertain about the future, and the USGA wants to make sure that they have a lineup that when you look into the future, it basically to the end of the 2020s, you know where you're going to be. You've got good primetime venues in the West Coast. You've got great classic East Coast venues. You're going from Shinnecock, you've got Winged Foot, you've got Oakmont, you've got Pinehurst number 2. I mean, you've got good venues on the East Coast. You've got some great West Coast venues. We've got Pebble Beach coming up in 2019. Now we've got it again as part of the known cycle. We've also got Torrey Pines in, 2021? And then in 2023, we've got Los Angeles Country Club, which is an untested venue in terms of the U.S. Open. It is a modern club, but still fantastic and an amazing place in Los Angeles, right near UCLA. So also very interesting. So you've got this great lineup, and the USGA is trying to get it all squared away. And the second that Olympic Club failed, that it wasn't going to, it was clear that that wasn't going to work, the USGA went around and said, all right, well, we're going to get Pebble Beach on the schedule, toot sweet, ahead of our normal scheduling. They're normally every 9 to 10 years. This will be now 8 years, 2027, for the U.S. Open. So they're doing that, I think, as part of this arms race. And then you've got the PGA of America on the other side. They're looking at a new television contract in 2019. And so they've got to demonstrate value just the same way, except sooner. They've got a better chance at a big deal and a big money-making deal they'll lock in for a long time. And they probably want that 12-year deal that the USGA got, because the companies are going to pay that deal well into the future. Maybe look at try to look toward a 2030 end date, and you can get all that money and tie up the cable networks for everything that they've got that they can pay you now before it becomes less worth something. You know, not worth less, but lower in value because you just have fewer subscribers. So that's why they're going, okay, well, we're going to get Arana Mink. We're going to capture that Philly market. We're going to try and turn that into ours instead of Marion and the USGA. Screw them. We're going to go back to our place in Valhalla because we make maximum money there because we don't have to pay ourselves money to use the facility. We want to get into the West Coast market, so that's why we're in San Francisco not once but twice in a 10-year span with TPC Harding Park in 2020, and then you've got Olympic Club now in 28. So we've got them lined up. They've got to figure out a couple of other things. We've got Southern Hills, which is learning by process of elimination when between 2024 and 2030 it's going to host this championship because they've lost three possible dates in the last week, which is crazy. So we know there's going to be another one of those. So you've still got three more majors to announce between now and 2030. And you've got this other one with Southern Hills that you know is going to happen, but you just don't know what the slotted date's going to be yet. And so we've got our U.S. Open and our PGA Championship dates known basically for the next 15 years. That's insane. That's never happened. That's never happened. And I don't know that it's going to continue to happen, but I think it has everything to do with television. It has everything to do with setting things up now while the getting's good for future deals, for future issues, for future problems. They're doing it now. And that has led to the defection of the Olympic Club out of the USGA into the PGA of America's open arms. Same thing happened with Bethpage. I don't think that this will be the only facility that does this, but especially because you can consider the Southern Hills was a USGA facility. Now it is squarely a PGA of America facility. And there may be still be some room in there for that stretch of remaining dates into 2030 where you get some more experimental places, which I hope they do. I hope they really do. I hope that'll be cool. We're going to see another Whistling Straits. I mean, that happens. So you can almost put that on the board. So you've got two left to figure out between now and 2030. It's remarkable. The other cool thing I think, well, it's a cool thing. It's not the other cool thing. The other part of this that I think is interesting and cool is that the USGA and the PGA of America are seemingly being more public about the required ties to other championships that they run to host their biggest major. So for Pebble Beach, hey, we want you to host another U.S. Open, but we got to have you host the U.S. Women's Open. We got to elevate that tournament. Okay, we're in. They're doing it. Same thing with the Junior PGA Championship, or in Arana Mink's case, the Women's PGA Championship in 2020 is a bit of a precursor to hosting the PGA Championship. So I like that. I think that's important, but that is also probably in part a TV-based move because for both of these entities, they're trying to sell cable packages or rights packages that involve all of their tournaments or as many of them as humanly possible. So you can get more money if the Women's PGA Championship and the U.S. Women's Open go to better courses because courses can get people to watch them. Even if you're not necessarily the biggest women's golf fan, which I don't know why you're not, but whatever. If you go and say, all right, the women are playing Pebble Beach this week, I'm in. I love watching Pebble Beach. I'm going to watch that. Got it. And you're going to try and see more. I think you're going to see more of this as we kind of get to the end of the run of possible clubs hosting into the 2030s. But I think you're going to see more of that. Again, TV related, trying to sell a whole deal. You're not just trying to sell one tournament. And if you look at the ratings for the U.S. Women's Open this year on Fox, it was worse than the Women's British Open on NBC, a worse time slot, because no one watches golf on Fox. The ratings have been atrocious. And so when the USGA has to go and sell this product in less than 10 years, they're going to have to go and say, well, you know, it's really Fox's fault, but look at these great venues. Look at these great places we can go. You can broadcast from there. People are going to tune in en masse for those. We're going to get some big, big numbers. And the PGA of America can do the same thing. I think it's really interesting development. There is a turf war based in television contracts, and I think golf will be the beneficiary. I think golf fans will be the beneficiary. of watching better major championship golf venues. Hopefully we'll continue to see experimental ones, but I think it's going to be hard-pressed to see like a Chambers Bay get another crack at it because we feel bad for you, or and it has the potential to be brilliant, or for as much as I love Erin Hills, it's going to be hard for it to get another U.S. Open in the next 20 years. It's going to be really hard because this is where it's going. These are the definitions of what makes a good major championship now, and experimentation going to new markets, cool every once in a while. But from a television perspective, which is where the real money is, no offense to everybody that attends these tournaments in person, going to places that are tried and true and loved and respected is better for TV than going to places you've never heard of and have no intimacy with, and you lose people very quickly when things start to go awry. It's just a built-in excuse. All right, that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Not sure we're going to get a podcast in for Thanksgiving week next week, but we will try to wrap up 2017 in golf. The PGA Tour season suspends after this week. Then a week later, we get Tiger Woods' comeback. We will certainly do podcasting around that. And we'll try to get into December before we cut off around the first week or second week of December, and then come back in January with a full set of shows and all the stuff that we're trying to do next year, which is really exciting, but working out all the details of now. If you have a chance, we talked about on Twitter, give us a 5-star review on iTunes if you listen to us that way. Look up our show, either in iTunes or the podcast app. Hit that 5-star. We would dramatically appreciate it. We never really get reviews. We know lots of you listen, but we never get reviews. So I've always thought no reviews is good reviews because that means you keep listening, but it would help us reach more people. So if you give us a 5-star review, I would greatly appreciate it. Also, be sure to follow Golf News Net on Twitter, because we are going to start our 18 Days of Golf giveaway series next week. And that's 18 different giveaways of great golf stuff. Lots of varying things, expensive things, beautiful things to give away basically between now and a little before Christmas. Even if we get lucky, we might extend it and make it like 20 days of golf. We did that last year. So be sure to follow Golf News Net on Twitter. That is where all of the contests will run. A minimum condition of entering the contest is following us. Then you got to retweet something for each contest, but it's really easy to do, and you might get some really awesome stuff. So give us a follow at Golf News Net on Twitter. Okay, until next time, I'm Ryan Balanchine saying thank you for watching or listening. Sorry. Thanks for listening to us, and we'll catch you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.